Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, food, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones, no relation, by the way. On today's episode, we welcome Nui Wilson, Francis Lupai Ippolito, and Gigi Little, collaborators on the new picture book, A Tree of My Own, from Chi Ling Press. Nui is the book's author. She's a Karen woman who was born and raised in Western Thailand. She moved to the U.S. in 2007 at a time many Karen refugees were resettling here. Nui worked with several nonprofit groups to help with their transition, and she's worked with the Karen community for almost 20 years now in Utah, Oregon, and Thailand. A Tree of My Own is her first book and the first in a series she's planning on the experiences of Karen refugees. Francis Lupai Ippolito is the book's editor. She's a Chinese-American judge, writer, and indie publisher whose stories have appeared in Nail Magazine, the Buckman Journal, and several anthologies. She's a member of the Horror Writers Association, Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators, and Northwest Independent Writers Association. And she mentors young writers here in Portland. Gigi Little is the book's art director and its cover and interior designer. She's a writer, illustrator, and book designer in Portland, and in my opinion, one of the top cover artists in the country. She edited the story anthology City of Weird from Forest Avenue Press, and her debut novel, Who Killed One the Gun, is forthcoming from Forest Avenue in fall 2025. Gigi also is one of the organizers of the annual Portland Writers Picnic, which, as you'll find out, plays an important part in how A Tree of My Own came into being. Please join us for our conversation with Nui, Francis, and Gigi, which is already in progress. Nui, Francis, and Gigi, thanks for joining us in the KBOO studios today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Well, Nui, let's start with you, the book's author and a member of the Karen community. You grew up in Thailand. Were you from a family of Karen refugees who settled there?
I am not a Karen refugee. I am a Karen Thai who born and raised in Thailand. So I came here as an immigrant. So the Karen that are born in Burma, a lot of them are refugees that they crossed the border and came to Thailand. And now in America, most of them are refugees.
What about your family originally? Were they from Burma? Or
they are Karen Thai. They're born and raised in Thailand.
Does it go back to part of the family ancestors living in Burma and making that perilous journey?
Yes. I think if I can recall, at least one of my ancestors crossed the border many years ago and came to Thailand and lived in Thailand after that.
Now, the Karen in Burma are fighting what's currently the longest-running civil war in the world. This goes back to 1948 when Great Britain and the UK gave up Burma, or Myanmar now, as a colony. Can you tell us about the Karen and the situation in Burma? It really hasn't gotten any better since 1948.
Yes, since 1948, when the British left the countries, they're always chaotic in that countries. A lot of fighting for their land, a lot of fighting for be more autonomy and freedom. And sometimes, you know, it's really big one. And sometimes it's just like, oh, there's nothing going on in that country. But there is still like fighting. Mostly the minorities want to have their own freedom.
Now, I read a little bit about the history of the Karen and what's happening in Burma even today. The Burmese military began a campaign against the Karen in the 1960s. It was called Four Cuts. And that forced a lot of the Karen to relocate. And it was just terrible from what I've read. Burmese soldiers burned Karen villages. They killed, tortured civilians, raped women and girls. It's not widely known here in the U.S., so the book was quite a learning experience for me. Has that been your experience, too, with other people, readers, saying we didn't really know anything about the situation there?
As a Karen who grew up in Thailand, my life pretty peaceful compared to the Karen that born in Burma. And I know very little about the Karen that live in the other part, the other side of the land, until I'm about 18 or 19, where I, you know, know more about the situations and learn more that there is war going on, and there's a lot of refugees live in many camps along the border of Thailand. But for many of even the Thai, current Thai, we don't know much about this. I'm sure that if you know...
And that's certainly the average American.
Yeah.
Like myself, I guess, if I'm considered average, knows absolutely nothing about it.
No, it's just you don't know about it. It's just, you know, a small country somewhere out there, and you have to really have some connections so that you want to learn or know about them. Or if you read newspapers, and back then I don't think there are, you know, many resources to learn about. And the news, you know, people went to that country and got the news out to the world. It's limited. So...
Well, that's why I think your book can serve as a way of telling that story and spreading that knowledge.
Yes. The book provides a background knowledge about the Karen and also Burma. So if you want to go deeper, then you can go and look around and check out the YouTube, check out the newspaper, check out other resources. It provides pretty solid background about the Karen.
Now, the violence against the Karen continued, certainly past 1960, the 1980s, even today. Many of the Karen, including those now living in Portland, fled the country, I think in the 1980s, according to the book, just as the young girl in a tree of my own called Posada, which is Karen for the youngest child, has to flee her village. And her father tells her, "It's no longer safe for us to live here. The Burmese military has been destroying nearby villages and burning their crops. We need to move." Sadly, that's not an uncommon experience for the Karen.
It's common. You're talking about how common?
Yes. I mean, it sounds so awful, and you'd hope that, okay, this just happens occasionally, but it's pretty much status quo there.
Yeah, it's pretty common for many people who live in the village far away, because the Burmese military want to get rid of you from that area, and because of you have no education and you don't have, you know, voices, so it's just the way how they can do it, you know, easier than go to the city and find a Karen there. It's easier for them to go to the village and get rid of those people and have them to move, burn their crops and get their things, and then control that land, piece of land. That's how they do it.
And they've been doing that for a long time.
Yeah, they do it for a long time.
Now, when the family in the book leaves their home village, they have to walk for many days to reach a refugee camp on the border with Thailand, Burma and Thailand. A very difficult journey for the Karen seeking refuge. I mean, that's frightening.
It's frightening for everyone, and
they can only take what they can carry.
They have to take only what they can carry, and very little, and not only a few things for them that they, you know, want to take. They have to leave everything behind, and some family have to travel, you know, many days because of, you know, even though you cross the border, you think it's very short distances, but it's actually, it would take a long time in the jungle with, you know, creatures. And then you have to be careful about the Burmese military that are, you know, around in that area, landmine and soldiers keep, you know, in the jungle too.
And they're on foot.
They're on foot.
When they escape. So, yeah, it's not like they're driving
through
the forest here.
Nope.
The refugee camps, once the Karen get there, they're tightly controlled by the Thai government, barely tolerated. The refugees can't leave the camp, and they have to support themselves while waiting for resettlement, which can take a long time. You mentioned before we sat down before the mics, that there are a few Karen in the camps who are able to make it into Thailand surreptitiously on the sly and get jobs and send some money back, but that's not easy to do or safe.
Once you become a refugee in Thailand, there is a rule, and the things that you can't do in that camp. So one thing is that you can't get out of the camp freely because you're not Thai citizen. You are not, you know, you came from Burma.
Right.
So for you to get out is like illegal. So, but for some people that have been living in a refugee camp for a long time, they want to get a job. They want to do something else rather than just sitting and waiting for food and waiting for help. So some who has, you know, some skills would go out to Thai village or in the city, get a job, and they take money to the refugee camp to their family.
Now, when they do get out, they're resettled. There are tens of thousands now of Karen refugees now living in the U.S. The book says about 500 here now in Portland. The largest community is the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. How did the refugees decide where to find a new home, where to resettle, and why Portland?
They can't make that choice. They cannot make the decision that I want to go to New York. I want to go to Las Vegas. People here tell them that, oh, this family, we will send you to this area. We want to send you to this location with organization that support you. For example, if there is an organization, I think
we have here the Oregon Karen Association. Are they involved in some of the resettlement?
The group that helped the refugee group is, I think, Catholic Charities, Immigrant and Refugees Organization, and they have to have some certain fund that they say, oh, we can have, you know, 20 Karen in Portland. So they will choose, you know, 20 people to Portland. And other areas too, I think there's an organization that say, oh, we can have about these numbers of the Karen refugees here. And each location has their own organization that help resettle.
Oh, supporting. People getting resettled.
Yes.
Now, I have to ask, given the recent election here, which is somewhat terrifying for all of us, are the Karen who resettled in the U.S. concerned about getting deported now?
I have not heard about it because they came to this country legally. Mm. So there's no concern, and at least, you know, so far I have not heard that they worried about getting back to their, you know, refugee camp because they came here with the legal papers.
Right, they're not undocumented.
Yes.
One more question before we get to Francis. In the book, you refer to the country as Burma. I just want to clear that up. It's commonly called Myanmar now,
yes,
at least in the U.S.
Yes.
Why Burma?
Wow, this is very complicated answer. I suggest everyone to look at Wikipedia, and they say, why is Burma or Myanmar? Why?
I was able to find at least two somewhat conflicting explanations.
Yes,
One was, of course, the military junta that took over with the coup, mm-hmm, referred to it as Myanmar instead of Burma. But also I've heard that outside of Burma, it's referred to as Myanmar.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe they're not so conflicting, but they're two different explanations.
There is, when I look at it and when people ask me about Burma, I said to them that this is a very difficult question to answer because, you know, when you look at the definition and Burma in Wikipedia, they will explain why. Long detail. I'm like, okay,
yes.
This is so long, too long for me to explain to the people. Okay, if you're interested enough, you should go and look and search yourself.
But we'll be referring to the country as Burma.
Right now,
and
people want
the Karen people Burma. Usually refer to it as Burma.
Burma,
not
yes.
Myanmar.
Yeah.
Now, Francis, let's talk about your background. You're Chinese American.
Yes.
When did your family come to the U.S. and how did you settle in Portland?
Oh, well, I came when I was 3 in the 80s. So we came and we were in the South. We had Chinese restaurants in both Florida and Alabama. So that was definitely a little bit of a different experience from living on the West Coast. So my aunt was in Taiwan and she married a man in the military, in the Army, who was stationed in Taiwan. And after that, they traveled all over the world and then settled in Florida. And And at the time, she basically wanted everyone to come from Taiwan to America. And we weren't sure. I mean, I was a little kid, so I wasn't really sure what to expect. But definitely, I think when we all came and I was a young child, I basically stopped talking for about a year because the transition from having been in another country and speaking another language and then being dropped in with all my cousins who only spoke mostly English, although they did speak some Chinese, it was a little bit of a shock to me, and so my brain had to catch up. about a year, maybe a few months later, almost a year, I started yelling at my cousins because they kept taking my toys, and that's when they knew I was okay.
They were comforted.
Yeah, they were comforted with the
yell
fact.
Yell at her some more.
Yes. She does speak.
So you definitely are directly aware of the immigrant experience.
Oh, absolutely.
Like the little girl in the book.
Having lived in different parts of the country, both in the South, in the Midwest, and South Dakota, in Los Angeles, in the Bay Area, Portland, and also having gone to school on the East Coast, I feel like I have a good sampling of all sorts of different micro cultures, but also kind of the greater connection that we have in different parts of the country.
Now, in the intro, you mentioned you work certainly as an editor and publisher, and certainly on this book, but you're also a judge. Why did you go into law, and how and why did you become a judge rather than, say, a practicing attorney?
So I'm an administrative patent judge, and I always wanted to go into law. I was one of those kids who was good at different subjects. I was a big nerd. I was a very big nerd. I was not very socially popular in high school, but I was the one who was always on the science bowl team. Like, I was that kid. And I thought I was going to go down a science track, but when I was in college, I realized that I also really enjoyed, I love books. You know, books were like my life as a kid, too. So I really wanted to combine the two, and patent law was kind of the key because I could work in the technical and work with inventors and work in the science, but also write, which is what I really enjoyed doing. And it's sort of a communication skill to be able to dive deep into like really hard technical information, but then also try to explain it to non-technical people.
You're not from the Karen community, obviously, but as an Asian American, you've had your own experiences with hate and intolerance, including, I read in an interview you did, one frightening event here in Portland. Can you talk about that and its effect on you?
Yeah, so I was at a Whole Foods, you know, just a random day, a random morning. And this was also during the height of the pandemic. So not necessarily the best time for being out and about anyway. But my mom and I were at the store. We were coming out. And then a woman was whispering behind us. And basically, I think she was kind of expressing her opinion that the pandemic was caused by, you know, Asians and Chinese Americans.
Or Wuhan flu, whatever they were calling it.
And so what she did was she kind of came behind and tried to push me down. But that wasn't really the big deal. The big deal to me is that she had a child with her, and the child was so confused. The little girl was like, what is going on? I don't understand. Why did my mom just do that? And that's what stuck with me, is that the kid didn't understand what was going on.
Yeah, people aren't born that way.
Yeah, exactly.
They become hateful and intolerant, I think.
Yeah.
It's not a natural condition. Well, Gigi, we've talked several times before doing interviews for your previous books as editor for the fiction anthology City of Weird. Mm-hmm. And then your husband, Stephen O'Donnell, who's sitting with us in the studio here, his art book, The Untold Gaze. Yeah. And we've talked for the annual Portland Writers Picnic, which you help organize each year. That picnic, as it turns out, plays a very important part in the book's origin story. It's where you first met Nui and Francis?
Yes, it is.
Can you tell us about that first meeting and how you got involved? Did they Gigi, hey, we need an art director.
Well, as happens with a lot of people I meet in the writing community, Steve Arndt, who is the main picnic organizer, actually, came up to me and said, you have to meet these people, and brought me over to them and introduced me to them. And I think at the time, Nui was already holding court with like maybe a couple other people talking about this book. And I sidled in and heard about it. And I'm going to say, like you were asking before, about people knowing or not knowing about the Karen. I had never heard of the Karen until I met them and until I got involved with the project. So it was...
And they were able to fill you in at the picnic on the situation. And then they talked about the book they were planning too.
Yeah, and the first thing that I heard was the idea that, or the fact that these children in the Karen community, each child gets their own tree. And I don't want to give away the stuff about, you know, I don't want to, that should be, you know, for Nui to tell.
Oh, yeah, but, we'll get into that a little bit about the story and the tree.
she was telling it so beautifully. I was just, the idea of a child having their own tree and what it meant was so enchanting, you know, and so I wanted to be involved immediately.
Now, I think, I forgot if this was an interview or in the author's notes in the book, but Nui and Francis had been working on the book for about a year before you met them. Mm-hmm. What was the project status at that point? Was there some text that Nui had and some outlines, maybe any sketches, rough sketches?
There was the whole story in text, although there was tweaking that happened after the fact. But there was the story, and then there was a set of sketches that the artist in Thailand had made already.
Oh, okay, so they had already found Kayor.
Yeah.
Who's a Korean artist and living in Thailand. It is an interesting story behind that, Francis and Nui, also, how you found Kayor. It was thanks to social media, which can be a good thing occasionally, right?
Yeah,
in this case, at least.
I think in the beginning, I told Nui that if we were going to make this book, we had to make sure that we found an artist who could really capture the heritage and bring that to life. Nui always says I have high expectations and standards, but I think in this regard, I wasn't going to compromise on it. But it was hard because, you know, given that we already had a shortage of books because, you know, ongoing war, you're not taking your books with you. If you have any, the likelihood that you had a bunch of artists who were also making art about the Korean culture, you know, it's hard to find that, especially if people are doing that, you know, in their homes, maybe by hand. So I asked Nui, I said, how are we going to do this? And I sent her on a search because part of it is that I don't speak the language or write in the language. So I don't know what to search for if I needed to search.
You can't just Google Korean artist.
Right? No, not. If you've Googled Korean book, you're going to find very few. And so it's even fewer for artists.
Mm-hmm. And Gigi, apparently, it didn't take much convincing to get you on the team.
No.
Yeah, but one thing I learned that I didn't know, talking with you before and doing the research and on your background, is that you wrote and illustrated two picture books of your own previously. Mm-hmm. You say in the author bios in the book that you published these under an old name, and I quote, with even more G's in it. So maybe three or four.
Yeah.
So it wasn't a stretch to work on a picture book with Nui and Francis.
Oh, no. I mean, and that was part of the reason that I wanted to be involved. Picture books are one of my big loves. I was lucky enough to have a couple of picture books published. This was a long time ago in small press and a really lovely experience.
And those were for children, picture
books? Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. Same age group. And with those, I had written and illustrated them. But yeah, so when this came along, that was definitely, you know,
you were interested in the story and you already knew how to do a children's book.
Yeah. I mean,
by,
it was
by
too,
doing a few of your own.
You know, Nui's story and just the fact that it was a picture book made it like the perfect project for me. Yeah.
Now, Nui, in addition to being a Karen in the Karen community here in Portland, you've worked with Karen refugees, Thailand, also Utah, and here in Oregon for almost 20 years now. What were your reasons for writing A Tree of My Own to help tell some of these stories? And also, I think, as Francis said, there wasn't really much available in terms of books about the Karen experience.
Yes, there's no Korean book that talk about the Korean refugees in the market. That's the reason. And also, I work with the Korean for many, many years. And when I talk and discuss and share story with them, I just realized that it's really important that the next generation should have should know their heritage.
I was going to ask about that because you have children too.
I have children too. So it's for my kid and for their kid and their grandchildren too. But how are they going to teach their kids? And when we talk, and when I talk with them, they have a limited resources about the book. And also a lot of them that came here at a very young age, never been outside Thailand, live in the refugee camp, never been to Burma. So how these people who are now American gonna teach their kids about their heritage?
Yeah, so, other than Wikipedia.
Like Wikipedia and some of information there is not quite right.
No, no.
It's not, you know,
it's
accurate.
Community sourced.
Yes, so that's what my main, you know, goal that this is going to be for them, that at least they know about their heritage, that they have to know that a long time ago, your ancestor have this tradition of having trees, and you have trees. If you were born many years ago in the village, in the jungle, and you have to take care of these trees, and that part of the living with the nature.
Are there any other children's books about the Karen story, about Karen communities? Are you the first? Would you say?
I think so. I think so. I have
hopefully the first of many.
I hope so too. That we have, we can, you know, share the story, and people can create more books about their, you know, life as a refugees. So there aren't many. That's for sure.
Yes, certainly not for children. There was one book I was able to find. I didn't get it out of the library or read it. It's by a Karen activist and writer, Zoya Phan. I think it's pronounced P-H-A-N.
Yes.
And she wrote a book, not a children's book, called Little Daughter, a memoir of survival in Burma and the West, about how she was driven from her home in Burma to a refugee camp in Thailand. And members of her family were actually killed by the Burmese army. She was able to find asylum in the UK, and this is her story. I was wondered if you had read the book and you were inspired by that also when you were writing A Tree of My Own.
I have her book at my house, but I think she talked about a tree in her book, and she talked about her, I think her dad is a soldier, and they kind of have to get out of the countries and be in UK. But the inspiration for me is that from the refugees I work with, that there's a lot of time when we share stories that they refer to the tree. They refer to the life in the village. And when I visited Karen in Thailand, in the jungle, I usually take my kids at a young age to the village. To experience the life of the Karen, real life, as much as possible. Whereas, you know, that village have no electricity. You have to squat at our house. You spend time in the jungle most of the time.
These are very difficult conditions that they're living under in the refugee camps.
This is not, what I'm talking about is the Karen that live in Thailand.
Outside the refugee camps,
this is a Karen that have a house and is a Thai citizen, but they have like a regional house, a Karen traditional house in northern Thailand. So I usually take my kid when they were young in summertime to that village to get to know the Karen, because I want to teach them, and the best way to teach them is that they have to have a real experience with the Karen. The point is that when I take my kid to the village and talk to the Karen in the village in Thailand, they have a tree. And they often refer me, oh, that's my tree. And the person say, that's my tree. I usually go there and hang out under the trees. And I'm like, oh, you have a tree. And when I asked my grandma, she said, yeah.
Well, that's how you learned about it.
And then when I talk with the Karen that are from Burma, they also have a tree. And then I, you know, study more about it, talk more about it, and everybody talk about trees. And I'm like, okay, I want to have my own tree too, but why can't I? But anyways, that's how I get into the story of get the tree in the book. Part of it, I think Soa Phan book refer a little bit about the trees also.
And that kind of ties the whole story together. It's kind of brilliant the way it works out. You're using the tree as kind of this foundation for the story, but we learn the difficult conditions they live under in Burma and then in the refugee camps, and then the problems they have when they resettle in the U.S. and how strange an experience that could be for them. Now, Frances, we talked about how you and Nui met Gigi. How did you and Nui meet and connect? She must have told you about this story, huh?
Well, that's the funny thing. You and I have known each other for quite a while now. We actually met at the gym. We met each other basically swinging kettlebells and exercising. And we're both parents, and we both talked about our kids. And then I started asking her, like, oh, you know, I noticed, you know, you talk about the weaving of fabrics and stuff, because I've seen some of this in her house hanging on the walls. So I asked a little bit about that. I'm like, oh, is that a Thai thing? Like, I don't think I've seen that before. And then she mentioned, oh, yeah, it's Corinne, and I've worked with the refugees. And I had no idea that we had Corinne refugees here. In fact, I didn't really even understand how much Portland has welcomed refugee communities into the city, refugees of all backgrounds. And so when I asked Nui to tell me more, and I started to do the same thing, which I think you've done, which is to search, it was a little bit of a shock. I would say I was actually kind of horrified, as somebody who loves books, that there were no books. And so I said to her, look, we're going to do this. I'm going to start a press, and you're going to write a book. And she looked at me like I was like, are you okay today? Like, what did you have for breakfast? And we had a bit of a discussion about whether or not she would write. I think, I don't know, Nui, I think eventually you said to me, well, I'm not a writer, but I'm a storyteller.
And that's what caught Gigi's eye. You were telling the story at the picnic.
Yes. I told her that I have lots of a story because I like to talk with the Korean refugees. I like to talk with all the refugees that I work with, especially young ones, because they have, you know, just they like to share their story. Older Korean refugees take a little time for them to warm up, and then they share their story. But I want to know the life of the Korean refugees in Burma compared to the Korean that live in Thailand. So what is it in common? What are the differences? So that from listening to the stories, I gather so many of them. I'm like, oh, wow, the tree story is interesting. And I think starting my generation, I don't have tree. So, and my kids don't have
I was going to ask about that, but given the significance of the book's title, A Tree of My Own, and we've kind of been waltzing around this, this significance of the tree in Korean culture, what is the role of trees in the culture, especially for children?
I cannot answer that question like straightforward, but what I can say is that when I talk to people and they have different answers about the trees, and some said that, oh, it's spiritual. It's like the tree and the kid or the child always have connection to one another. It's like you kind of like a companion for the rest of your life. And some people say, oh, it's just a tree that you have to take care, and once in a while you go and, you know, look at it and make sure it's healthy. And, you know, there are different answer why you have to have tree. But it come to the same answer, is that the tree is part of that child. It's something that it will be, it's like a friend, and it's like a something that you have to look after and in your lifespan.
Yeah, it was very interesting to me when I read the author's notes. There's something you mentioned in there called De Paw Law. And that's where I think a Karen law, probably not Burmese or Myanmar law, that is forbidden to cut down those birthday trees because they feel it might do some harm to the child associated with the tree.
That's what they believe, that there is a special connection of that tree and with the child. So it's prohibited to cut down the tree. And they really believe. I think this is come from the belief of animus, original Korean animus, and they
kind of a living force,
spirit. Uh-huh. Believe in spirit, and they really believe that cutting down the trees that you tie your things, you know, your part of your body with it, it's gonna hurt you. It's gonna do harm.
And the father in the book tells his girl, the youngest child, so Posada, that he hopes she grows up strong, beautiful, and useful, like the tree. Mm-hmm. So the tree is not only this soulful connection, it's also kind of a role model for the mm-hmm. for the kid.
Well, when you when the parent went and go to the forest to pick out the tree, they usually pick the one that are, you know, tall, that are healthy, beautiful. So it's like your child. The tree have to be like your child, that you hope that the child is healthy and useful and beautiful. Oh, like right. The tree. You will not pick the one that are almost to die, or, you know, unhealthy, or has some kind of, you know, animal bite to it. You pick the healthy one.
Right. And there's a further connection too, which you talk about in the book, but also in the author notes, is that a birthday log is kept by the family. I think in this case, the child's umbilical cord was cut by the woman who was attending. She puts the umbilical cord in a bamboo log, and then this is carried around, and a mark is made each year of the child's birthday. So it's a way of kind of telling age. Because you said that often the exact birth date of a Karen child is not recorded. It's more like, and I'm quoting from the author's notes, born 5 years ago in the rainy season. Mm-hmm. And so it's not just a ritual, it's almost a record of the child's birth and aging.
These refer to the Karen jungle life. They don't have education, and writing is not part of their culture. So how you keep track of things like your anniversary, like your kid's birthday and your age, what they do is that they make a mark on a piece of something. So usually it's the pole in your kitchen or the pole of your house, make a mark and with the name of one of your child, or the name of yourself, and that's it. Okay, one mark here, okay. It's not accurate, you know, 100%, but at least
it's
roughly
good enough
that, okay, this is your actual age. But you don't have, like, January 18 is your birthday. That's
right.
Not
you don't have a birth certificate.
You don't have
a right?
certificate.
That's on file somewhere.
Yeah, there's no like that. No birth certificate. It's on your pole somewhere in your house that keep a record.
Now, Frances, as the book's editor, how did you work with Nui and Gigi, too, on the text itself? The language for a children's book has to be so concise, and something that a parent could read aloud to their kids over and over again. In many cases, when my kids were young, I think we read Curious George and Babar the Elephant hundreds and hundreds of times. So that's very difficult to do in a children's picture book where you don't have a lot of text to work with. It has to be just right.
Absolutely. Usually children's picture books are 1,000 words or less. And I think in general in the market, that actually might be at the higher end of word count. Probably there's a push to go lower. And when you have a book that basically goes into three different locations, all pretty different from each other, and you have to kind of deliver this emotional journey that at each location is pretty significant. Yeah, we had to really start big, you know, have a lot of text to kind of explain mm-hmm. What we wanted to see.
And then cut down.
And cut down. But also it really came down to Gigi being the book whisperer, as I always call Gigi, because I needed to know for myself, not being very good at art, even though I have in my mind a visualization of what I would like, to understand how much to trust the pictures to show. Mm-hmm. Because the words can only do so much anyway in a children's picture book. It's a collaborative storytelling.
Oh, exactly. Yes.
And Gigi just came in and pretty much was like, just let me sit with this for a moment. Mm. And then she came up with the storyboard where we had sketches. We had all the pieces, but we didn't know how to make it all just synergize. And that's why Gigi came in and actually saved us, I would say, because we were stuck.
Gigi the one? Were you the one who did the storyboarding?
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
So even before Kayor did the illustrations,
the full illustrations,
you kind of had some idea of what you
yeah.
wanted him to illustrate.
Yeah. I mean, I took his sketches, and then some of it was just me sketching stuff out on my own. But yeah, so the art had a beginning, and I just sort of shaped it from there. And then he took the storyboards, Kayor took the storyboards and then made it beautiful.
And one of the other things that I had to consider is that I knew, because of resettlement and displacement, the Karen community as a whole is scattered. So we're talking about communities in America, but also communities in New Zealand, Australia, Japan, Netherlands,
the
India.
Scandinavian countries, I saw.
And I've had readers reach out to me and ask, will this book be in another language? And so from a, you know, my publisher brain, you know, editor brain perspective, we also wanted the text to be, you know,
Translatable,
because the illustrations will definitely bring a connection to the communities with this common kind of story. But the words, the more words we have, the harder it is to fit it on the page, depending on what language we're moving into. And we've already started to work on the translations because, you know, I think unlike some books where you try to expand your market by translating into German or whatever and think that there may be readers who want to read the story, we have a market that is essentially scattered already in origin.
But you also have plans to translate into Thai?
In Thai, we already have the translation. We have to just put it in. And also in Karen. The title actually on the cover of the book is also written in Karen. All different languages because of this concept that we can share this story with the Karen community, but also the communities they're in. So it doesn't matter if you speak Spanish or read in Spanish or in French or whatever language, you get to understand more about this experience.
Now, I want to talk to you, Frances, about Qiling Press. And you said you started it to publish Nui's book, Judy's book and your book and Tyre's book. But you have other objectives with the press, right?
I do. Yeah, it started with this idea that, you know, I told Nui from the very beginning, I said, you know, you have many different ways of doing this. You can go the traditional route. There are lots of indie presses. But if I were going to do it, I would do it as a nonprofit because I think the money should go back to the community. And so we talked.
And that's what's happening with the book.
Yes.
So you're giving it back to the pretty much all the profits from the book.
We are trying to do that. Right now we're trying to pay the expenses of printing the book and then with that be able to continue to make the second one. We want to do three books, and the second one will be about the weaving tradition. But the goal is to show that this is a sustainable market where, you know, business model and market where you can write the stories and share the stories and collect the stories and preserve the stories from communities where, you know, there's not a lot of story keeping being done, and then be able to make money but also give the money back. So it is in its infancy, but so far I think with all the support from the community, I can see it working in the future. I just think that we're only, what, 6-7 weeks out from when this book was officially released, and we have been basically doing events and every
non-stop.
We have library events, school events, and next year. We've only been to one bookstore so far, and it was Powell's, which was amazing.
But that was the book launch?
Yeah,
we haven't even had
a chance to really go to other stores to talk about the book. And I'd like to partner up with the distributor to get into more schools because we have the kids in Southeast schools. We have the Karen kids there, so this book should be in the library there.
Yeah, that was so heartening to see at the Powell's launch. Again, it was a story time. I think it was, was it a Saturday morning at like 11 o'clock or something like that?
Yeah.
How many of the kids showed up? And their parents, of course. So it was a packed house.
It was,
And I have had people from Powell's come to me at different places that I've been to. I'll be there for some sort of book thing. And I had someone come and say, this little girl was walking around in her traditional dress, and she pointed to the book and said, look, that's what I'm wearing.
And that's a Chua dress?
Chua.
Because you mentioned in the author's notes that there's, for unmarried women and girls, they wear the Chua dress, which is white. And then when they get married, they switch to a two-piece outfit. That's darker.
Darker, with patterns. Uh-huh. It's still colorful, but different.
And I was able to see all that at Powell's at the event.
Oh, you went there?
Oh, yes, I was there.
Oh, you was there?
Yeah. So I saw the Karen community show up. And, they had the unmarried women and girls, you know, in the white dresses, and then the darker black dress, a two-piece outfit, I think it was.
Yes.
Yeah, again, with the patterns. And you even went into some of the weaving that was done. What was it called? A backstrap loom?
Yes.
So the weaver becomes part of the loom in a way.
Yes.
What a connection.
Yes, so you attach to the loom for many, many hours to get one piece done. Sometimes all day, all night. So you have to love it to be able to do
And you have, I think Frances mentioned it, that you have in mind writing a book on Karen weaving.
Yes, the second book going to be about weaving.
Would it be a children's book, picture book like this?
Yes. I think with the picture, it's kind of help people, you know, to see and can pictures about their life easier. Rather than just, you know, text. So I think picture book would be best to let people learn about the cultures.
I actually think a picture book has a wider audience than any other type of book. Because like I said, when my kids were young, I was reading picture books to them. So not only was I reading it over and over again, but the kids you'd find out pretty fast if they were bored. but if they were into the book, you know, Dad, you know, read it to me again.
You know, that's the point. You have to make them want to read the book.
Right. And I think you succeed here.
Thank you.
Definitely. Oh, Frances, I wanted to ask you about the name, Qiling Press. So I looked it up. It's kind of a mythological creature in Asian culture.
Yeah, it's like a giraffe, horse, dragon.
Why did you pick that?
Well, you know, I think as a kid, and even now, a lot of what I write in my writer life is about folklore, and in particular from my heritage. And the Qiling is this creature that's sort of protective and wise. I thought, oh, yeah, that would be pretty much my mascot for any press that's dedicated to literacy, education, and community. It's like, yeah, of course I want a giraffe dragon to protect us all.
You also write sci-fi, fantasy, and horror, right?
I do. I write a lot of everything. I write nonfiction essays. I've written for children. So in that way, when I was talking to Nui about this, we had a little bit of I don't want to say a head start, but I already knew in my mind we had a few formats that we should explore. We could go with a chapter book to get more details in, but we ended up picking children's book, which I think actually is probably the hardest format for a writer to take on, because you have to have that partnership with the illustrator and art director, but you also have to be so concise in what you're saying in the actual words, and you have to have a whole story that is taking place over just 32 to 40 pages.
It's and you mentioned the three locations, Burma, Thailand, and Portland in the book.
And so it's quite challenging, which is why it took us almost like 2.5-3 years to finish it. But the hope is that we can do at least three. I told Nui at one time jokingly, "You got to do a book a year." And she looked at me like I was going to drive her crazy. But I think we want to do three because we have in mind what we'd like to do.
So this book, the weaving book,
and then the wrist tying ceremony, which is a holiday, and be able to create a curriculum guide so that way the teachers have resources for how to teach about, you know, refugees and also cultures and how to bring that into schools.
Now, one thing really stood out. I was reading an interview you did, Frances, in the online magazine called Bold Journey. And you said, I'm quoting, "Crafting a meaningful life is more fulfilling than pursuing happiness. I try hard to view challenges and successes through that lens. The same applies to projects I take on. I ask myself how the work I choose to do creates meaning." So with all your projects, this is kind of a way of keeping you from burning out and staying focused, but focused on an extremely important goal. You know, it's not just to make money for your press, obviously.
Nui and I always joke, like, we don't make any money. All the money is going back to the books and to the community. And we don't really think about it too much. I mean, I think we're tired because we're like, oh, this is essentially a full-time job and more. It is nonstop. So you have to love it. It has to be really intentional about how we spend our time and why we spend our time, because we are essentially doing so much for just one
book.
Well,
all three of you do an incredible amount.
Yeah, it is nonstop. When we were trying to get the book actually, I'll say birth, it was like having a bunch of midwives, you know, around surrounding this book, hoping that it would come out and hoping it was a cute baby, you know, you just want it to work. And I think...
The book should have its own tree.
It should have its own tree.
It should.
Yeah. So I would say that this has been a very intentional, purposeful project. I think it's brought meaning to all of us in our lives. Mm-hmm. And I think most important is just seeing those kids. And some of them hadn't been to Powell's mm-hmm. before. This was like the first time they'd gone to Powell's, which is a big deal.
Oh, no, it was so nice to see all of them there. And they all kind of gathered together and took a group picture, too, which I loved. Yeah. I was in the back with my little phone camera kind of documenting it as well. Now, Gigi, I have to ask you, because I hope we're talking later in the year, or next year, 2025. Yeah. We mentioned in the intro that you have your debut novel coming out next fall from Forest Avenue Press. Can you give us a little preview of that? It has a very interesting name, and it's based on some noir and old-time radio, which are big interests of mine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, I'm kind of obsessed with old-time radio. The book is called Who Killed One the Gun? I think of it as sort of like Groundhog Day meets Dashiell Hammett through a little bit of a Twilight Zone lens.
Well, I can't wait to read that.
Yeah, the language is very much based on old-time radio detective shows. And yeah, it's a time loop noir novel.
And that will be out in the fall.
Yep,
I also read,
October.
I think this was in the author's note, that you're working on a children's picture book under your own name. So Gigi with just two Gs.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, I've been working on a picture book for probably 15 years or something, like for a really long time.
Wow.
That I just did on my own, that I sort of poked around with around all my other projects, because beyond writing and working like on this project and having a day job, I am a designer, so I design books. So yeah, it's taken a really, really long time to kind of just fit
in. You do a lot.
Yeah.
I should also mention you're one of the best. I think I mentioned in the intro that you're one of the best cover designers in the country.
Oh, thank you.
You're just incredible
yep.
work.
Book
thank
whisperer.
And a book whisperer. It should be on the business card.
Yeah, I need to get one of those.
Yeah. Now, Nui, let's leave you with the last word here. In the author's notes in the book, you have a section titled Hope for the Future. Mm-hmm. There's still civil war in Burma. Many of the Karen people have left the country, some settled in Portland, other places in the U.S. and the world. And in the book, the girl, Posada, wishes to return to her tree in Burma one day, maybe with her new niece, who's born in Oregon in the book. Is that the hope of many of the Karen refugees to return to their home country?
This book based on true story. So when I think about how to end the book and what the message that I want to give an audience. One thing is that a lot of them hope that one day they can come back to their homeland and live in the way that their parents and their ancestors have been doing for many, many generations. So a lot of people, especially who are older generation, wish to return home.
And have you ever been to Burma? Would that be dangerous for you to visit, or is it even allowed?
I have been to Burma many, many years ago, even before I have kids. Back then, you can travel to Burma with the limitation. But nowadays, it's very dangerous, and I think you shouldn't go there at this moment.
But you've traveled to Thailand with your kids.
Yes.
In fact, you're going to Thailand in a week or two, aren't you?
Tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
Going to Thailand tomorrow. We go to Thailand every year. I want my kids to know about my heritage, Thai and Korean. So every year we try that our kids should go to Thailand and visit the Korean in the village.
Well, Nui, Francis, and Gigi, thanks again for talking with us today. And thank you for this extremely important book. I learned a lot about the Karen community in the country and what's going on. And hopefully that information gets out to more widely. I think your book will play a big part in that.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KABU Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show, would just like to hear it all again, You can stream this episode and previous episodes online at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, J-O-N-E-S-Y, or just search for it on the KBOO website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guests today, Nui Wilson, Francis Lupai-Ippolito, and Gigi Little, collaborators on the new picture book, A Tree of My Own, from Qiling Press. You can find out more about Nui, Francis, Gigi, and the new book online at qilingpress.org. That's Qiling Press, spelled Q-L-I-N, press.org. I'd also like to thank SW Conser, host of KBOO's Words and Pictures, for helping us with the recording. Just a reminder that KBOO's year-end membership drive ends soon, in just 5 more days. Since we get about 80% of our funding from our members, listeners like you, we need your help to reach our goal of $75,000 by December 31st. You can support programs like this and independent media by becoming a member today or renewing your membership. Just go online to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. All of us here at the station, even Jonesy himself, thank you for that. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 10:30 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, January 9th, 2025, the new year, at 10:30. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation sane. Hope to see you all again in the new year.